Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Well, cool, Dan. So we've spent a little bit of time just kind of talking about your formative years, kind of your early prodigal years, your decision going to mission, the wonderful spiritual experiences you had going on a mission, and your time after as an MTC instructor, etc., and your decisions to kind of pursue graduate work in religious studies at Arizona State. I'm kind of assuming that this is where kind of maybe things start unraveling a bit. So why don't you talk a little bit about the unraveling?
All right. That's a fun way to think of it. I was sure that I was at Arizona State to learn about religion, and for whatever naive reasons, I thought that it would only enhance, you know, the truths of Mormonism, to learn more about the early church fathers and, you know, the formation of the Christian tradition. I thought that would just, you know, fortify that, you know, our view as Latter-day Saints of, Jesus had 12 apostles and organized a church and, you know, let's make sure the priesthood is, you know, I just thought that it would just give me this fuller background for, you know, fitting the Mormon story. And the complete opposite happened. There was this moment in my first semester, and it was pretty late into it. I remember recognizing quite early that the things that I was studying, one of the best classes I ever had was methods. They call it methods. And so the different methodological ways that you can approach religion. So there's the psychological approach to religion, sociology, anthropology, you know, all the different kind of schools of thought that, you know, try to explain why religion works as a phenomenon, all that. So that was a wonderful thing. But, you know, I never wanted to let any of those so affect me that I think, oh, religion really is just the opium of the masses. You know, I never wanted to really consider, you know, accepting those theories wholeheartedly. And so I remember kind of somewhere getting along the line of, you know, I've got to start letting some of this in. I got to start, you know, really considering some of this stuff. And so I just made that choice of being less resistant to the danger that this spelled for my current worldview, and just let's ride it out. Let's see, you know, how far the rabbit hole goes, or where it takes me. So there was that conscious decision to say I've got to yield at least somehow to the power of these theories. The biggest thing though that came along for me was, I took a class from Burton Mack, and it's kind of interesting because here's my first Claremont connection. I'd heard of Claremont because I'd been attracted to something called process theology when I was at BYU in my philosophy program. So I knew Claremont was a place for that. But Claremont has a school of theology who wanted to partner and kind of open up sort of a pathway or a gateway for people in the Phoenix, you know, Tempe, Mesa area where Arizona State's located, for them to take classes locally in Arizona that would then, but they'd be classes from the seminary. So in other words, you could get a lot of credits for the seminary and for your ministerial degree or whatever it is you wanted, just staying locally. So they started to send professors while I was at Arizona State, and I was able to register for some of these classes. So I took this class with Burton Mack, who is the most delightful person in the world. He's still one of my favorite guys. But he is an absolute, you know, big New Testament name kind of scholar whose most famous book is called A Myth of Innocence. That just basically, if you're going to take any spiritual, you know, God, you know, God directing the formation of early Christianity and the development of the Christian story and who Jesus is and all that stuff, if you're going to take God out of all of that, that's Burton Mack. He is going to lay out for you, you know, the development of, you know, of early Christianity, the development of the Jesus story, you know, the taking of, you know, these Q, what they call Q, the saying sources, and you sort of take the, oh, you know, you take the teachings of Paul and you put them together and you have this guy, you know, the Mark is generally considered the first gospel. So, you know, anyway, I shouldn't go too much, but basically all of
it sounds like Bart Ehrman stuff.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So what happened was I have this delightful teacher who is, it's undeniable that scripture is not an exception to the general rule of any other kind of writing, that, you know, people who write a scripture, they're trying to tell a story in a particular way. They're shaping, you know, the message to fit social conditions in some ways and things. And so just whatever, you know, idea I had that somehow scripture was a special case, that it was free from human influence, that it was, you know, directly channeled from God, and, you know, any of that idea that it was, you know, perfectly conceived and brought forth, went away during that class. And that was really the hardest thing for me. For whatever reason, it kind of seems weird to me that somehow I was invested in scripture being the exception to everything else. But anyway, that led to, you know, of course, me having to ask about other scripture, including the Mormon scriptures. And so for whatever reason, that was my pathway to where I probably started rethinking my Mormonism more than anything else. And at least, now it's time to really buckle down and sort the fact from the fiction and, you know, the sacred story from probably what really happened.
Okay, so your entry into the rabbit hole was a deconstruction of the New Testament. Is that a fair way to summarize?
Yeah, along with, you know, these methodological things that, you know, you get a group of people together and, you know, you create a feeling of excitement that can sort of feel like something spiritual. You know, you're the crowd of, you're united together in the crowd at the football game and you feel a spirit, you know? So there was those kinds of, you know, other theories about, you know, what makes religion powerful that were there, but certainly the scripture was probably my biggest, jaw-dropping and most depressing time.
Okay, so once that fell, so you were questioning the historicity of Jesus in the New Testament then?
Yeah, I don't think I doubted that he existed, but certainly the idea of you know, him as Son of God, you know, all the stuff that kind of came in after, you know, from Paul, you know, all that stuff that sort of, you know, worked its way into the telling of the Gospels, you know, that he's, you know, secretly the Son of Man and he's revealing himself left and right, and that, you know, those who have eyes to see and whatnot. I was totally just sure that was all constructed. Yeah.
Okay. So a resurrected Jesus then.
Yeah. I mean, I can't say that I was 100% this didn't happen, but it's like, wow, this is a far more complicated story. And I'm certainly a lot less sure.
The credibility was weakened, maybe, or at least your preconceived notions.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tease apart exactly what happened there. But yeah, when you for the first time really say, oh, maybe this isn't true exactly the way it's been presented to me, you kind of you enter into that new relationship with your faith. And so, you know, it's like Fowler. There's that great line. He says, you know, we don't know who discovered the properties of water, but we know it wasn't the fish. Right. You know, this is that moment when you're kind of stepping outside your story and saying, wow, that is a story that is constructed in a certain way, that, you know, there's more going on here than just an innocent, you know, straightforward telling of something factual. There's shaping at work.
Okay. So once that fell, just give us a listing off of the other, some of the other things that fell. Like, did you follow the traditional path of, reading Fawn Brody and church history and all that?
I didn't read Fawn probably for another 5 or 6 years. I guess what really happens then is, so, okay, my church and what I learn at my church and the way they present scripture doesn't match up with what's really going on. Now, of course, I don't think to this day, I didn't think even then that Burton Mack had it 100% right. But, you know, it was undeniable that there was a lot of human, you know, things going on there to create the scripture that we have today. So, you know, I'm not saying that I 100% bought that his theory explained scripture totally. So anyway, but back to the Mormonism and how the different things fell for me there. It's like, okay, we were wrong about this. What else, you know, what else doesn't match between the sacred story, the sacred narrative, what I'm being taught at church? What else doesn't match with factual things? And, what would be the laundry list of things that you begin to question? I guess everything. Somewhere along the line, I know priesthood became a big thing with me. I don't know who was that introduced me to the idea of, you know, why would God require, you know, somebody, you know, anyway, for whatever reason, I just never felt like the priesthood and giving a blessing and having insight into, you know, some situation, some spirit of discernment needed priesthood. I thought everybody should be able to do that. And so I somehow or other, right early on, I kind of started to think, you know, maybe priesthood is just a power that's available to everyone. Maybe it's just the nature of spiritual connection itself. And that if you put yourself in the right frame of mind, you really can discern a lot. You know, again, this is where Tyler and Randy, or Tyson and Randy, who many of your listeners will know, I interviewed these guys who, you know, left Mormonism for atheism. They would start to, you know, this is where they'd really start to debunk this. But I sort of believed then, and I still believe now, that, you know, if you quiet your mind and you give yourself permission to say, I have the right and the power to, you know, be a blessing to this person and serve them in this way, I don't really think that you need the laying on of hands, you know, by one holding the keys in order to do that. And so somewhere or other, that was very early for me, that this idea that the Mormon Church had exclusive authority. I mean, I don't mind that there's these rituals by which we, you know, place our hands upon other heads, another person's heads, and you convey something to them in terms of blessing or love, and we're uniting you in this chain. You know, you know, my son gets united to me. I'm united to my grandfather in this priesthood chain, you know, all the way back. I don't mind that all that works at that neat level. So I'm not against priesthood conveyance there, but somehow or other early on, I just began to see priesthood as perhaps like Dumbo's feather. Dumbo thought that he needed the feather in order to fly when he could fly all along. I started to begin to see priesthood as that way of giving yourself permission, you know, to open your heart to the universe, or to truth or discernment, or the powers that connect and whatnot, and, you know, and serve others. So that was one thing that's kind of early, but you name it, at some point, I believe in my 10 to 12 years of real wrestling, you know, where I just like, I don't know what I'm thinking from one week to the next, you know, just whatever comes along that week, it's got me, you know, my head spinning for a while. I'm sure I went after about every possible thing. I don't think that there's anything that I would ever failed to try to deconstruct.
Right. So yeah. Joseph Smith and the First Vision and, you know, Book of Mormon, historicity, you know, the whole deal.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, historicity of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith's claims. All of them went there. I mean, I don't, you know, I believe that I always honored, and I always will honor, no matter where I land on the Book of Mormon, I honor the role that it played in my life. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, there's many other things that, you know, can change people's lives as fundamentally as that changed mine. Mm-hmm. But I can never not say that that's a powerful book, because it was powerful to me. Whether it's historical, you know, whether Nephi and Lehi ever took a breath in this world, if they're real people or not, you know, it doesn't matter. That book, I'll always honor the power of that book in my own life, in my own journey.
Sure.
Same thing with Joseph Smith. I mentioned that I'm a deep, you know, kind of, I love the grand ideas, the grand theory of everything, this putting all together. I mean, there are so many doctrines that Joseph Smith teaches that, to me, are powerful. And so even as I'm wondering, what the heck is this guy doing, you know, marrying a bunch of women? You know, I don't know that I believe for a second that polygamy was inspired by God. I can't deny that, you know, some of the scriptural passages, you know, provided, they were gateways for me into this really deep, exciting, profound, you know, sort of paradigm changing views that I have in this world about, you know, who human beings are, you know, divine potential, view of God who wants, who's not up there trying to protect his turf, who's basically saying he's inviting us all to become, you know, like him, them, you know, if we were to consider the married couple model. I always hate to use just purely male pronouns.
Sure.
So there's these amazing deep parts of Mormonism that became a real part of me. And again, in my study of philosophy, you know, Joseph Smith, it kind of feels to me that, you know, as chaotic as some of the things were going on in his life, there were these moments in certain passages of scripture where, you know, he throws this little idea out there, like all spirit is matter. You know, it's only of a more refined nature, and if our eyes were more purified, we'd see that it's still matter, you know? I mean, you know, he kind of throws that out there. I don't think he's doing any kind of systematic theology. And yet that, you know, provides a really interesting angle that, you know, it doesn't solve what they call in philosophy the mind-body problem. But it certainly shifts it, because now we're no longer dealing with, you know, the classic formulation is, how can something that's purely mental, that doesn't exist in time and space, you know, it's got no physical substance, how does it interact with the physical brain? You know, that's the typical mind-body problem. Well, Joseph Smith basically has matter acting upon matter, you know, that kind of thing. And so just these weird little moments of Joseph Smith, this idea that God could cease to be God, you know, that comes out of a broader philosophy that I've found to be very profound. That is, that's not like it, something isn't right because God commands it. Something, you know, God commands it because it's right. In other words, there's something embedded into the fundamental nature of the universe that God can't work against, choose against, and remain, you know, somebody who's powerful in the way that, you know, that you handle, like you said, then now you can move. See, my brain is just starting to free flow from all these really cool scriptures, you know, section 121, this idea that, you know, you live a certain way, you let virtue garnish your thoughts unceasingly, you do this, and then without compulsory means, you know, just the rest flows unto you. And it's sort of like, I tend to believe now that Joseph Smith is right, that you step into a place where you're just naturally handling the powers of heaven rather than, you know, God is pushing a button and saying, I now choose to bless John DeLynn with the following experience. You know, I just sort of really believe that Joseph Smith intuited a lot about it. So again, even if I'm deconstructing Joseph Smith and polygamy and polyandry and, you know, half the stuff that he does and who knows what with Kirtland, you know, bank society and, you know, all the different stuff in church history that's so troubling, I'm just like saying, I don't know, this dude had moments where he seemed to step into something pretty profound. And so I always would honor those, even as I'd wonder, you know, would I have continued to follow Joseph Smith if he had propositioned my wife?
Right.
That kind of thing. So.
Right. Okay. So you have sort of a thorough deconstruction, of your testimony, but you have, you know, signposts along the way of some spiritual experiences and some theology and doctrine that you read that sort of stick to your ribs, so to speak, and keep you anchored in trying to make Mormonism work, right?
That's interesting to put it. Is it what's making me try to make it work? Yeah.
Well, here's I'll say.
Yeah, so let me ask. I guess so. I guess so. There's. I'll tell you. Throughout this whole thing, I felt like I was on a good path. So even as I'm pulling it apart, you know, somehow or other, either, you know, my deepest self, my soul, whether, you know, my spirit is in, you know, in another realm where it knows that this is an important path for everyone to go on, who knows, whatever it is, I'm feeling all along that I'm not sinning through my doubts. I'm not sinning through my, you know, pulling apart and demythologizing or whatnot, because I really was looking for what I could count on, what I could hang my hat on. And so there's this, I don't know if you've probably heard this phrase. It's like from Oliver Wendell Holmes. It says, you know, I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but for the simplicity on the other side of complexity, I would give anything. You know, I'd give my whole soul. You know, King Lamoni's father, you know, I'd give up all my kingdom. I can't remember, is it half my kingdom or all my kingdom, you know, to know this God that you're teaching me, Aaron, you know, in the Book of Mormon or something. So there's this idea that there's this simplicity that I had. Now I'm in my graduate school years and, you know, I'm studying and I'm wrestling and all that stuff. But I somehow knew that I was passing through something and things would become clearer to me again. Yeah. If I just stuck with it. So I don't know if it's spiritual promptings or whatever, or it was just good friends that I had made along the way. I'll tell you, this is, you know, it's 89 that I meet a fellow named Randy Paul, who after I left Sunstone, that's who I've gone to work with, so I'm now known him for 21 years. And he was that friend who came along in my life who I just somehow connected with. And he's, you know, I don't remember, he's 10 years older than me or whatever. And he's just a little farther along on the path than me. You know, I recognize him as he's asked every single question that I've asked. And he's, you know, he's managed to somehow say, you know, it gets better, Dan, you know, or consider this, you know, look at where the church was on this issue X amount of years ago. Look at where they are today. Give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, it's like Martin Luther King Jr.'s big phrase, you know, the arc of history, you know, kind of points you towards justice sort of thing. He's kind of like, the church moves along at the pace that it moves along. It's a church of free agents. It's a church of people all along different paths, different temperaments. Just because you're a church leader doesn't make you brilliant. You know, so he was kind of helping me through all that stuff that I think a lot of people get hung up on. So I'm just grateful that I had a friend like him. And so then he's the one who said, you know, read Sunstone, read Dialogue. And so, you know, I mean, I'm going to the Arizona State Library and I'm, you know, reading past issues of Dialogue, and I get to that, you know, Dwayne Jeffrey, Science and Mormonism, science, you know, it's the Seers, Savants and Evolution, you know, that whole issue where he lays out, you know, what is it about the age of the earth and what is it about evolution that we as Latter-day Saints really need to sort of say, this is our firm commitment and how much of it can we go with science? And so I'm reading all those things and I'm kind of having a really good experience with, you know, broad-minded Mormons, even as I, you know, I still had to do the work of, you know, pulling it apart and pulling it back together. They couldn't do the thinking for me, but I sort of saw people that had emerged with, you know, what I considered a respectable faith, as well as, you know, a mind and, you know, based in solid theory, solid science, etc. They had managed to make it work. So I was just helpful. It was helpful just to have those guys on the horizon for me. And then Eugene England became a person that I read several years before I first went to my first Sunstone Symposium. He happened to be the opening speaker and my jaw just dropped that I was like, okay, I now know what spiritual maturity is. I knew it when I recognized it in Randy. I see it with Gene England here. I am like this complete, you know, I mean, that's the kind of maturity I want to gain for myself. And they sort of just became, you know, attractors, you know, planets that kept me in orbit around Mormonism while I figured out all these different things for myself.
And just so that our listeners can relate, so you did have, you know, moments of inactivity or discouragement or frustration. Like, you know, how many years were you not active in the church or really doubtful about your position with the church?
Okay. Right when we moved from Claremont to Utah, well, I wrote my dissertation. So, you know, I finished all my coursework and passed my exams at Claremont. And then we moved to Utah thinking, who knows where life's going to take us after this. Let's move back for a couple of years where my wife can be near her family and friends. And during that later part of my dissertation writing, I began a period of inactivity that probably, I mean, I never fully went inactive. I mean, they all knew who I was at church because I'd show up often enough that not a lot of people would think of it. But most days I was heading over to the Unitarian Church because there was just, what church became for me during this period, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners can relate, is like, everything I'd hear, oh, that's just simplistic. Oh, you're just relying on emotion. You know, you are, you know, how can you testify to that as true when I know the facts don't support that? That is absolutely not what happened in church history, you know, that you're hanging your hat on. And right. So church just became this, like, this game of like, oh, how can you guys not know this other stuff? Because it took me a long time to realize, okay, guess what? That was me just how many years ago? That was me before grad school. That was me before these experiences and these opportunities to focus full time on these questions were, how can I, you know, I mean, much later I became very forgiving of people who haven't had my experience. You know, they're on their spiritual journey where they are. They are most likely way ahead of me on, you know, being outwardly focused towards loving their neighbors, you know, towards, you know, serving in the community, whatever it is, you know, I try to give people the benefit of the doubt that they're way ahead of me in other areas, even though I may have a little bit clearer sense of church history or, you know, or the facts of the matter. But anyway, so I was inactive for a while, and the Unitarian Church became a really good thing. I went, you know, Tom Goldsmith was the pastor there at the Unitarian near the University of Utah. And I would go, and it was just so refreshing to be with people who were united in a community, and they were talking about good things, and, you know, the sermons were always insightful, and, you know, I remember getting introduced to Barbara Kingsolver, the novelist, right, and spiritual writer and stuff through those things, and so I was growing spiritually that way, but it was so neat. I remember one day just thinking, you know, these people, they're putting on some big party, and they're, you know, I can't remember their Christmas thing or whatever it was. And you could tell that a lot of work was going into it, and they had a lot of enthusiasm. They did this great presentation during the service of, you know, why everybody should get up excited and come to it. And I remember just thinking, you know, not one single person there is doing this because they think that somehow their salvation is tied to it. Right. You know, they're not feeling guilt. Oh, if I don't serve in my calling, you know, I'm not going to do it. And so it's just so refreshing to have people that united for good purposes and good values without any sense of guilt or something attached to it. They did it because they wanted to. So I did that for quite a while. Tom Rogers, do you know who he is?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, he's a BYU professor and well, retired now, and a playwright and whatnot. Anyway, he became the Sunday school teacher in my Bountiful ward. We were in the same ward. And so somehow or other, I'd heard of Tom, you know, through Sunstone and whatnot. I started going, I really became, you know, I became like a fan of his Sunday school classes, and he and I became friends, and I found a friend to talk to at church. And then there was another guy who I won't name his name because he's still working at the church in the historical department. We found each other and became friends. And so it's sort of, for me, the heading back to Mormonism at that time was because of Tom Rogers and this other friend. And now I had somebody to talk to who I knew wasn't, you know, thinking terribly of me because I'm not 100% or, you know, I'm not a TBM anymore.
Right, right.
So that was one period. And then when we moved out to Bountiful, I mean, so when we moved from Bountiful out to Tooele, where I live now, we're in our second home here. So this is my previous ward. I was really struggling. I can't remember exactly why I would come to church, but I was really keeping it at a distance. I guess I was still in that mode of picking apart everything I was hearing. And I remember coming home from church a lot and, you know, just my poor son, you know, he's 10, 11, 12 years old at this time. And he's, you know, he's just hearing me vent, and I have no clue what he would have thought of, you know, just kind of let it all out. So church wasn't a happy time for me, but I continued to keep going and keep going. And for whatever reason, like I've already told you, I'm not sure anything about priesthood and if that's, you know, required that you receive priesthood from somebody else and you pass along. But I did want to ordain him a deacon. And I told this story on the podcast about stages of faith, but we had a bishop, good man. I can't to this day fault him for, you know, trying to be a leader of integrity or whatnot. But we ended up with, he came over to offer me a calling. And it was right after my wife had sort of told me that she had had a conversation with him and he had started asking about me and wanting to get to know more about me and stuff. And she had told him that I was struggling or whatnot. And so then he shows up to offer me this calling and I kind of say, well, that sounds fun. I wouldn't mind being, I can't remember, I think it was teaching the 10-year-olds or something. But I kind of thought, I'm really surprised that you'd offer me a calling after what my wife told you. He goes, oh, what did she tell me? You know, and so I start laying out all my struggles. And John, it was like, and I don't believe in this. And no, I don't believe in this. And I'm not sure that there's a devil, you know, and I'm not sure that there's a God. And I have no clue about the atonement of Christ and why that would work. And it just makes no sense to me. And I don't even know why temple work. It makes absolutely no sense that God would require, you know, people to be united in a priesthood, you know, chain of, welding links and all that stuff. And for whatever reason, I mean, this guy sits there for 45 minutes and all he hears is about what I don't believe. Mm-hmm. And so his jaw's kind of dropping and he goes, let me rethink of, you know, extending this calling to you and I'll get back with you. And he never, you know, came back with the calling and that was fine with me. And I just continued on with however it was. Well, then my son turns 12 and the bishop is shocked when I want to ordain him. And he goes, you're kidding me. And I go, yeah. And I start telling him all the positive reasons that I want to, not that, you know, and to me, they were good reasons and I wouldn't have felt like a hypocrite doing it. Cause I'm, you know, I really saw it more in that anthropological, you know, this is a good thing to have priesthood, to, you know, to see priesthood as a reason to serve other people. And, you know, I know that I'd feel close to you. You know, it'd be a nice thing for us to have that connection of me putting my hands on your head and saying good things and blessing with this and conferring a priesthood, even if it is, you know, just permission for you to want to grow and serve people in this way. So anyway, I kind of told him all that and he goes, well, let me think about it and pray about it. And then a few days later, it's the morning of, he calls and he says, Dan, he goes, I just don't feel good about having you ordain your son. And then the one reason he gave, he says, I just don't know that anybody who doesn't believe that Jesus is the Christ or doesn't know that Jesus is the Christ should be able to do it. So to me, that's a little bit bizarre that was the thing he picked up on out of all that. But he decided not to. And it was weird. I was pissed. My wife was pissed. You know, our son was real excited, and if you knew our son, he's like the life of the neighborhood. He's the most outgoing kid, and all the dads in the neighborhood love him because he wants to talk hunting and fishing with him. And you know, he's just really connected with everybody. And I didn't want to disappoint him and not have him do it, so I didn't know what I was going to do that whole meeting, prior to ordaining him, or you know, going in and sitting on his ordination. And so finally, it does come, and it was kind of neat because there was, I don't know who he'd invited, but there were seven or eight of, you know, the guys in the ward, good guys who all got up there and did the, performed the ordinance with him while I sat with my wife on the chair on the outside. And they finish and they're shaking everybody's hand at the end of the whole thing. And I stand up and it just like whatever. Something came over me that said, you know, I want everybody to know here that I very much wanted to ordain my son. Bishop and I disagree on whether, you know, it was right for me to ordain him today. But I want you to know it's not because of any worthiness issue. It's just that my view of the gospel and the church and priesthood and everything is very complicated right now. But I'm in the middle of a wrestle with it. I said, I know that you only wrestle with things you care about. And I love my son, and I'm so proud of him. And I appreciate all you guys that are here in this room today, the good examples you are, the way you've taken him under your wing, et cetera. And, you know, for whatever reason, those 3 or 4 minutes that I spoke were just, they just flowed out of me. And I felt like, you know, something good came out of this day. I was able to say things from my heart that were good. And I'm sure everybody who didn't know what the heck this crazy guy was going to say, you know, when he's left out the ordinance, they were all relieved that it was positive in that way. And so anyway, that was my ordination with my son. And it took a couple more years. I'm sure I was inactive off and on again, you know, for those months, just because it was just too painful to go to church. Not because of this event with my son, but just again, I wasn't happier coming home because I was just, you know, wrestling with what I'd heard and deconstructing it all. So there were a couple periods where I really wasn't going. So, but again, I somehow or other found the groove again and found reasons to go. I don't know if they called me to a calling that I accepted and then started to feel accepted by members of the ward, even if I'm unorthodox in this way or the other way, they valued what I could bring. And who knows, the next thing I know, I've been pretty active ever since.
All right, Dan. So you've kind of brought us up to the present in terms of coming back to activity again. And I kind of would like to take some time to really have you articulate your testimony from top to bottom. Because to be honest, I don't know many people who have been able to do what you do. There's a lot of people who go through sort of a phase where they maybe think they can make the stale DS kind of approach work. And it may even work for a time, but a lot of the people that I work with end up not being able to make it work. I would say there's probably a lot of people that I don't know who are making it work just fine with a nuanced, you know, stage five like faith. But for the people I know, it seems relatively few and far between. Definitely not sort of with the sense of peace and satisfaction in the church. So I'd like to take some time just sort of discussing how you've pieced your testimony back together and how you look upon some of the main central components of a traditional testimony. So let's begin. You alluded to this in the Atheist podcast, but tell us, you know, what God is and isn't for you.
Let's start at the top. Huh? I don't know that there's a God. If there is a God, I'm not sure it's a personal being. But there's a piece of Mormonism that, you know, at least is compelling enough for me that I definitely hold open the strong possibility that there is a God. And that piece from Mormonism is, again, that what I think I've alluded to a little bit earlier, that whatever, you know, God is, or however God works within the universe, it isn't a universe that God created. It has, you know, a character all of its own that God has to work with, you know, in order to do any creating and, you know, bringing something into being. And so, you know, this whole idea of from the King Follett discourse of, you know, God finding himself in the midst of spirits and glory, saw fit to institute laws by which others could, you know, come up and sort of have the experience. I can't remember how the rest of that phrase goes, but have the experience of becoming gods themselves is sort of the gist of it. That is kind of the way that says to me that I, whatever the universe is, if it has a way of if somebody, it makes sense that somebody could align themselves with the powers of the universe or the potentialities and the energies of the universe in such a way that they could sort of control them. Does that make any sense there? So, uh-huh. One of the big, you know, dividing lines in religion is personal God or impersonal force. So you either have, you know, beings with personality and whatnot, or you have something like the Tao or Dharma, or the sort of this idea that there's this impersonal force that sort of, you know, organizes the world and holds it together. Well, the thing about Mormonism is it kind of can address both. It says, yeah, the real stuff of the universe is this way of, you know, there's this force that sort of holds it together, or there's this uniting principle or something, but a being could step into a position to where they can sort of understand those and then therefore be somewhat of a creator and a mover and a shaker within that universe. So does that make sense?
Yeah.
So like godhood is an achieved state the same way that Buddhahood, you know, at a certain point where you might have an enlightenment experience, you might receive the same sort of insight as the Buddha. You know, within Mormonism is called becoming a partaker of the divine nature. You know, get yourself in such a way that your character has aligned itself with, you know, love, compassion, you know, no coercion, only persuasion, only gentleness and meekness and calling and, you know, charity never faileth and all that kind of stuff. You know, once you've achieved sort of that character trait, I'm okay calling you a god. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah.
So again, I don't know that there's a God, but I'm open to it. And I don't know. I really regret doing my little percentages at the end of, you know, the conversation with Tyson and Randy. But, you know, I just think there's enough there that I certainly am not going to close my door on that. And again,
but how do you so how do you be a Mormon or an active Mormon and have, you know, uncertainty about the existence of God at a level you're willing to articulate? Most Mormons are going to say, I know that God lives, you know, and I know that he loves me. And it's a total, I've never heard someone, you know, really stand up in their testimony and say, there might be a God, I'm open to the idea. And yet they're still in full fellowship teaching and participating. So how do you jive that?
Well, I can't say that I articulate it in my testimonies that I've given, you know, over the years. You know, there's certain rituals and formulations, and I can't remember, somebody posted on just the Mormon podcast community this cool thing from Terrell Givens that says, I know when I'm going to testimony, meaning I'm stepping into a certain rhetorical space, you know, that kind of is different than everyday conversation or how I might, you know, view my academic life and stuff. So I recognize that, and, you know, I don't do that in those settings that call for something else. But on the other hand, I won't ever testify that I know that God lives. My testimonies have all been centered on the experience of love or honoring the goodness that I find within the church and the people who serve. It'll be, you know, centered on these profound experiences that I've had. Not that I'm telling the experiences, but I'll testify to the fact that I know that, you know, I'm an eternal being, or I believe that I'm an eternal being, and that I'm grateful for the gospel, you know, for you know, cause, you know, leading me to step into these kinds of experiences that I'm testifying about. So again, I, you know, the stuff that I'm sharing with you here, I probably wouldn't share even in the priesthood lessons I teach, you know.
Right, that's my right,
current,
right. Okay,
my,
well,
my current calling,
I'm not,
so
I'm not as worried about what you say to people. I'm more thinking about how in your own mind you feel like you're legitimate or like you're like the others, how you don't either dismiss other people's claims or be frustrated by them or feel inadequacies by your lack of knowledge.
Okay. The last question, the last part of that, inadequacies about lack of knowledge, if I don't address that, make sure we come back to that. But let me share an experience with you. It was just weird that I wrote about it in Sunstone in the Touchstone section for the most recent issue. Again, I don't know when this will be released, so maybe the issue before. But I had this really cool experience at that ward, the same ward that I, you know, wasn't allowed to ordain my son in. Just to follow up there, and I, you know, the next bishop had no problem with me ordaining him a teacher and a priest. So we were in that ward for 6 or 8 years or whatever, and I didn't have any other experiences like that. But there was a moment, and I know it was exactly 4 years ago, now about 4.5 years ago, because we're on the Old Testament. So the last time the cycle for the Old Testament came around. Must have been early in that year because the class started to discuss the Abrahamic covenant. And I had one of those moments where you kind of step out of time and space, and I just sort of I looked at what was happening, and it was the most amazing thing. If you know, it's hard to believe, but there was a very animated discussion going on in this Sunday school class about the Abrahamic covenant and how much everybody there was just telling their story about why they feel blessed to be part of this lineage and, you know, this connection to Abraham. And I'm stepping back and I'm going, oh my living heck. How long has it been since I even considered the reality of something like the Abrahamic covenant, or let alone that it could be a powerful force in people's lives? And, you know, and I'm just like saying, I am not like these people. You know, look at them talking, you know, inside this story. And it wasn't a story that I, you know, had stepped into really in that sort of way for a long, long time. So I had to kind of go, what is going on here? And I started to say, well, I bet every blessing that they're talking about coming from the Abrahamic covenant, there's a naturalistic explanation. You know, somehow they're tying it to that, but it's really because, you know, they lived according to some, you know, ethical principle, or, you know, there was more naturalistic reasons for them having the blessings. But I kind of said to myself, what harm does it do that they have tied it to this overarching sacred narrative? And I just, for whatever reason, I felt like this longing to be able to step inside the story again. And from that moment on, I began to more deliberately see what it looked like from the inside once more. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah.
You know, so I started thinking inside the box. I was very, but what was interesting is I felt completely authentic after a while thinking inside the story, to where I'll go ahead and you'd never know if I'm teaching a Book of Mormon class that I really don't know if these are real people. You know, I'll testify to the truths and the, you know, the spiritual insights or whatnot that I find there. But you won't hear me saying I know the Book of Mormon's historical, you know, ever, you know, kind of thing. But they would never know that. So somehow or other, beginning then, I was able to sort of see myself as now authentic, both within the story and without the story. And it reminded me of this really funny moment years earlier when I went to the American Academy of Religion conference. These conferences always start on a Thursday. They run Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And so I just happened to be, you know, attending a session on a Sunday morning, and it was some scholarly session. And it just happened to be a black fellow, you know, who sort of had the cadence of, you know, a Southern Baptist or whatever, you know, just sort of somebody from the South, but he's an academic. And he's doing this talk there. And, you know, he left his notes and he began to really get very, very animated as he talks. And all of a sudden he catches himself after this for about 4 or 5 minutes of this. He goes, oh, y'all have to excuse me. I didn't have a chance to go preach today. You know, in other words, you know, my real job as a pastor, as a preacher, I'm here at an academic conference and I'm doing academic work, but I'm kind of slipping into my preacher voice here. And he just recognized it. We all laughed and stuff like that. But to me, that sort of just, you know, it kind of displays this concept, or this illustrates this concept of, you know, here this guy was clearly able to do good academic stuff that would pass the muster of, you know, of a society of scholars. And yet, you know, he very comfortably would also be happy to preach, you know, salvation or whatever it would be in his thing. And I'm sure that he doesn't feel that much tension between the two worlds, because they are two different worlds. Like the Terrell Givens quote that somebody posted on the community site, there are different rhetorical spaces. And somehow or other, I don't know if that makes any sense to you, John, that I just somehow feel comfortable inside the myth, because the myths have beautiful truths to them. They've got some stuff that steers you in the wrong direction. And I'm the first one, you know, to, if somebody's telling the story in a certain way that makes God out to be sound like he's a judgmental jerk, you know, I try to work in a way within the story to say, you know, there are two ways to see that. There is a way to see God as, you know, withholding blessings from people and as punishment and stuff. And there's also within the story a way of seeing that, you know, you're not naturally going to get blessed unless you, you know, do this or that or the other. You know what I mean? So I can kind of correct things within the myth when I see them going wrong, but I'm comfortable in the story. And then when I'm talking with my friends who are outside the story, or when I'm, you know, doing purely academic work or something like that, I feel at home there too.
So you're characterizing sort of the church doctrine and theology as a story, and I don't want to mischaracterize it, but what that invokes for me is the sense that it's fiction, that it's probably not real, but that you're willing to sort of play along in a fiction because you feel good and you can do good and you have felt, you know, positive things as a result. But that's a very different, again, that's a very different mindset. You know, Gordon B. Hinckley, a lot of people really have fastened on to, you know, his statements that it's either true or false, that it's either exactly what it claims to be or the biggest fraud. And, you know, either Joseph saw God and Jesus or he didn't. Either he saw an angel or he didn't. Either there were plates or there weren't. And there's, you know, the church makes the claim to be true and God's one and only true church. And that's a totally different proposition than just saying, come be a part of our narrative. Come be a part of our story. And so you're engaging on a totally different frequency than the frequency that Mormonism engages you to participate in and validates. How do you get comfortable with that?
Boy, good questions, John. I don't think that I'm saying that it's just a story, that it's just a fiction that I'm going along with. I don't know if it's because of, you know, in fact, I wrote my master's thesis on theories of ritual empowerment. In other words, why is it that when you, you know, participate in a ritual, many people claim that they, you know, feel more oriented and organized and spiritual and they feel empowered after doing it. And so, of course, you get in order to wrestle with that, you get into the whole, what is a myth and what is mythic truth versus literal truth and all that stuff. And so there's absolutely no sense that I really want to convey that I think that the Mormon sacred narrative is just a fiction.
Okay. In other words, there's something, you know, there's something spiritual behind it. You don't know what, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that Joseph Smith had an experience. I don't know exactly what it is. Obviously, you know, he was still trying to figure it out because he came up with lots of different tellings, or at least, you know, we have recordings of different things where he would emphasize this or that or the other thing. But I think we do see a turning point in his life where he, you know, he shifts away, if you want to, you know, go to Rough Stone Rolling or whatever, from money digging and treasure seeking and sort of using what I think are some sort of a genuine, I don't know. With Joseph Smith, I sort of see it as more as that ability to dissociate from, oh, you know, I don't know, to sort of step into a spiritual realm and sort of, you know, feel oriented in a universe where you maybe receive truth more archetypally, or, you know, sort of in these vaguer, you know, sensibilities. You sort of feel truth rather than it comes through your mind linearly. So anyways, I see Joseph Smith as somebody who really genuinely had a gift for stepping into those realms and coming up with good hunches and good sensibilities of what the universe might really be like. But on the other hand, you know, once he comes out with the hunch, he starts, you know, putting it in the language of the religions around him. He starts, you know, creating more of a definite narrative that then becomes, you know, it's like, have you ever heard the story of, like, you know, here's a bunch of people who would have been in the same battle with each other. So some big skirmish in a war. And every one of them, you know, is processing that experience, processing. And there's hundreds and hundreds of different experiences that they may be having. So then all of a sudden, somebody comes along and writes the official history of that battle. Right. And guess what starts happening? All of a sudden, their stories and the way they tell their experiences begin to fit within that narrative. The river is created, and your story sort of gets within the current of the stream and all that. And so the sacred narrative, you know, gets formed within Mormonism, and it sort of begins a life of its own. And it has a touchstone, certainly, in events that happen. But you lose the freshness and the rawness and the confusingness of this rich spiritual experience you've had, and all of a sudden you begin to tell it in a certain way, or you start to remember it in a way according to that story. So when I'm talking about the sacred narrative, it's this thing that's developed in Mormonism that unites us, you know, and it gives us a shorthand to talk with each other. And it, you know, I remember that one Star Trek episode, The Next Generation, where, you know, Picard gets on this planet and he has to communicate with this group of people, and all their languages and stuff are basically, you know, stories from their mythic history, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so were at Agard or whatever it was, you know. In other words, our sacred story becomes, you know, this sort of common language that unites us all. And I can't really say that that's a bad thing. I'm mad when somebody who wants to investigate church history says, well, I found this and I found this and I found this, and I think this story is a lot more complicated than that. I'd be really mad for somebody to come along and shut that person down. But on the other hand, I don't necessarily think that person's complications of this really belong in Sunday school.
Sure.
They don't really belong from across the pulpit. So as long as the tradition, you know, allows for conversation like the type that Sunstone, you know, tries to host, and that, you know, different conferences and Mormon Stories podcast and all these different things of saying, here's the sacred narrative, here's what's really happening. Don't shut down somebody who's asking these questions or seeing it in a more complicated way. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't have that big a problem with President Hinckley, you know, preaching to the center and rallying the base by saying it's either this or it's either that. I mean, I know it's not either this or it's either that. And I somehow grew into that. I think I grew into it in a mature, you know, I've taken a mature spiritual approach to that. I understand that as an organizational head, you know, you shore up the center a lot more than you make the exceptions for the people on the margins. And, you know, to me, the whole point is just keep letting things like this discussion and this podcast and other podcasts and Sunstone Symposiums and in the pages of the different magazines and all the different blogs, let this rest of it flourish. And as long as that's happening, I really don't have a whole lot of problems with Mormonism and official what the church guys do.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, SKYE, pixton.com. Thank you.